Welcome to the Battle Archive. Since 2005, the Academy of Ideas has organised the Battle of Ideas Festival, with debates on the key cultural, political and scientific issues of the day. We are proud to be the home for unfettered debate, the People's Parliament, the place where new ideas come alive in open discussion. And now, we are opening our vault, making our recordings of public debate available to you, free to revisit and share as often as you like. For more free speech content and news on our next festival, subscribe below or head to academyofideas.org.uk. But for now, enjoy the discussion.
Welcome to this session. How to start an economic renaissance. I'm Angus Kennedy from the Institute of Ideas, and we have Phil Mullen, very lucky to have Phil Mullen here, who's going to, slightly different format, going to give a lecture based on his most recent book, Creative Destruction, which hope you, if you haven't read, you'll buy a copy from Phil afterwards, which will be its own small contribution to lifting the economy and putting some money in Phil's pockets where it probably deserves to be, and that would be good. But if you haven't read it, I do recommend that you do so. It's a very important contribution to the contemporary economic debate, not just in pointing out what's wrong, but in really trying to take on some thinking about what we might do about it, what would be involved in kickstarting the economy again. Phil will give a lecture for around 20 minutes or so. We might do a bit of chat up here, me and him, and then out to you for open up the conversation. But I think without further ado, Phil.
Great, thanks. Great, thanks very much, Angus. Thanks to the Institute for giving me the chance to give this lecture in an unusual format. And thanks all of you for coming along. I don't know what we're about. 30 feet underground here. So imagine, instead of being underground, you're 35,000 feet up in the air in an aeroplane. And the pilot announces, "We're having a few doubts up here in the cockpit about whether the theory of aerodynamics really does fly," pun intended. And on top of that, we're a bit concerned up here whether our engines are going to see us through to landing. You slightly anxious, I hope? Anyway, enjoy the flight. Now, that's similar to some of the rather startling things that the West's most important economic policymaker, at least for this week, has been saying recently, expressing doubts both about established economic theories and about the tools that she's been deploying. And she, as you have probably guessed, is, anybody guessed? Janet Yellen, right. Janet Yellen, who's currently head of the American Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, and as you probably know, there's a good chance next week that Bush will not reappoint her in February, but may appoint somebody else. Anyway, she awaits that decision. She's been questioning the Federal Reserve's economic models and policies. Now, you need to know something about central bankers. Central bankers, when they get the job, they're given this dictionary of very obscure ways of saying things. So her diction is not as transparent as the airline pilots, a bit more opaque. So what she said was that the models that the Federal Reserve use, quote, could be misspecified in some fundamental way. Now that means not working, okay? Yellen's the sort of person, if she dropped her phone, like somebody just dropped mine, and it broke, then she'd say, oh, my phone is misspecified in some fundamental way. So, you know, broken models. Yellen then continued, quote, persistently easy monetary policy, tool, persistently easy monetary policy might lead to increased leverage. Now, leverage, that, to you and me, that's debt, right? Might lead to more debt. Having, to continue what she said, quote, adverse implications for financial stability. Now, adverse implications for financial stability, that's another way of saying causing another financial crash like 2008. So this statement is something of a bit of a mea culpa from Janet Yellen, because this is no hypothetical scenario she's describing. Easy monetary policies have been exactly what she and her colleagues have been implementing extremely persistently ever since 2009. So basically she's saying models don't work and the tools we're using are likely to cause a financial crash. Reassuring, as I say. At one level, Yellen's statement is indicative of a justified lack of confidence in what she and her colleagues have been doing, because almost everywhere across the West, as we'll all be familiar, regardless of these very easy monetary policies, we've been having a very similar set, I would say, to simplify, a similar set of economic issues across the Western economies. We've got much weaker productivity growth, which we've been discussing in other sessions, productivity being the fundamental driver of our prosperity, the output that we produce in each hour of work. In Britain's case, as we've heard discussed in some sessions, productivity has actually been flat in the last 10 years. That productivity problem has been what's been underpinning the very slow, in some cases non-existent, growth in incomes for many people in the last few years. And while employment is at pretty high levels in many places, in fact, you've probably heard that it's at record levels in Britain, the government's very pleased about this, beneath those headlines of record employment is a big expansion in the relative share of lower value, lower paid jobs. So those are the common features, you know, more cleaners, more caterers, more minicabbers and so on have been the drivers of job growth in many countries. So those problems have been pretty similar. So while Yellen's comments are partly then an admission of the failures of the central banks to generate a genuine economic recovery, I think they're also illustrative of an important shift in economic thinking, which is really the first thing I want to talk about here. This shift, I think, has been consolidating since the crash, and it recognises that this is now openly recognised as not just being a very slow, drawn-out, cyclical recovery. But the recognition amongst people like Yellen that there are deeper problems holding back economic growth. So that's the first point I'll draw out. Secondly, I'll relate that to the current damage, which I say has been caused by economic policies. And thirdly, indicate what needs to change in both those areas, economic thinking and policy, in order to make an economic renaissance. Now, at one level, you could say it's good that there's less official complacency from people like Yellen about what's going on in the economy, a bit more honesty about what's gone wrong. It opens up a different type of discussion, perhaps when the next crash does come. But unfortunately, my main point is that this doesn't mean that there's a lot less economic fatalism around at the moment, nor is there a better grasp of what needs to be done to secure a return to sustained growth. Because if we leave aside the parochial sort of British obsession of economists here about Brexit and blaming Brexit on for everything that goes wrong, you know, which is obviously a dominant British discussion, but if we leave that to one side, misleading as I would argue that is, the dominant view amongst Western economists generally, and I stress Western as opposed to what's going on in more dynamic parts of the world, the dominant view of many Western economists who have been taking, in a sense, the same intellectual journey as Janet Yellen in terms of recognising things are worse than they thought, has been to blame what are called structural factors for all the economy's woes, or for most of them anyway. And three main factors are generally listed, and there's generally a list. Firstly, technology. Secondly, globalisation. And thirdly, demography. And you'll see that in many, many reports. Those are the structural forces which are causing these deeper problems. Now, I'm not particularly going to query the word structural, but what I do challenge, my main theme, is that the common presumption now is that we can't do much about any of those things or about their effects upon us. These three forces, these three factors, which are all interesting in their own terms, and we've had discussions about some of them over the course of the weekend, are invariably, though, presented today, particularly in the economic world, as these inexorable, almost elemental, natural-type forces, like, you know, gravity or time, you know, that they impose upon us, rather than, as in earlier times, we would see these three factors as things that we can act upon ourselves. And that's an important, you know, about turn. For instance, technology. We're always being told now that technology, and there's a session on it after this one on automation, we're always being told that technology is going to destroy this many jobs over the next 20 or 30 years, or that technology is going to limit the wage increases for those of us who survive that and fortunately still have jobs at the end of that period. I think that contrasts with a much more enlightened approach to technology in the past, which saw it as a tool. Technology as something which we could do great or perhaps bad things with, but it was something that we used for good or bad to make economic or social impact. Similarly, globalization. That's today seen, I mean, we see it from Trump and from many others. Globalization is, you know, the baddie. Globalization is causing bad things like job polarization, or it's causing an exacerbation of income inequality. Whereas in the past, you know, going back, you know, 40 years more than that, used to be the case that we would see foreign countries, in economic terms, as being places you sell to, you know, that you do something with, or places you go and invest in, not this force that imposes itself upon us. Or finally, demography, specifically population aging, which is now generally regarded as this horrible growth-killing burden upon us. Burden on public services, burden on pension costs and so on, and also a drag on innovation because apparently older people are supposedly much less productive than the youngsters in the hall here. And that again is a contrast because for much of the 20th century, we were rather pleased with the fact that we were achieving longer, healthier lives because, you know, at the minimum, it meant avoiding premature morbidity or death meant we had more time to enjoy things and to do things during those our years on the planet. So my point is, with all these contemporary structural narratives, what we could be doing to push the economy ahead is always being swamped by a sense of our lives being determined by these structural forces imposing upon us. And if we think about it, there's nothing new about any of those three factors. We've had, you know, for at least the last 150 years, we've had technological change, we've had global markets, overseas countries that we exchange with and trade with, and we've had demographic change, demographic aging, in fact, pretty much the same period of time, 150 years. But what is new is that only recently we've begun to view them, I think, as fatalistically, as these one-sided forces primarily doing things to us, that determine things for us, rather than as opportunities that we can avail ourselves of. Now, turning to my second point, the problem gets worse because this growing sense of fatalist resignation about our abject conditions, from Yellen to the other economists, has also been informing Western policymaking for at least the past 30 years, I would say, to give it a specific period. I think since Thatcher, this country, since Reagan in the United States in the 1980s, the idea of active economic policies, of human intervention to improve the economic condition, has basically fallen out of favor. Instead, most economic policy in those years has become about managing everyday economic life, whether it's just managing, you know, the budget, or managing the labour market as it is, just managing the way the world is. Instead of policies with transformative objectives, as was the case previously, we've seen the increasing adoption of what I call status quo policies, designed to maintain stability and limit anything that smacks of disruptive change. For instance, I think this pro-status quo impulse is very evident today in the Brexit discussions. And that's, you know, from both sides, you know, because whatever else divides them, all the leading British protagonists, I'm going to talk, not talking about Europeans, but all the leading British protagonists seem united on one thing with respect to Brexit, which is to seek to keep economic relations with Europe as close as possible as they are now. It was, you know, our chief Brexit negotiator, David Davis, who first articulated the goal earlier this year, in his words, of an agreement that will, quote, deliver the exact same benefits as we have now. And everyone else says, yes, great, that's what we want. I mean, we don't really want to leave, say some people, but as long as we can all agree that we want to leave things exactly the same as they are today, that's the objective, that's an expression of that status quo policy. No change to the status quo. And I think that's become even more farcical in the last few weeks as everyone's jumped on the transition bandwagon. No one seems to have a clue as to where we're transitioning to in, what, 2021 or 2022, but that doesn't matter. I mean, in the old days, when you talk about transition, it was generally from A to somewhere, B, D. You knew, it was fairly fundamental to know where you were transitioning to. That doesn't matter these days. No one cares about that at the moment. I mean, they will care about it in 2 years' time or whatever, if, depending on what happens. These people are, rubbing their hands at the fact, great, two more years of status quo. That's what we got. It's no longer 1919. It's now 1921, or, Thatcher's talking about 3 years and so on. So that's the impulse to maintain this wonderful, apparently wonderful status quo is what drives a lot of our political life. And it's not just over Brexit. I think this pro-stability urge is apparent across a range of economic policies. I think you see it in public spending. I think you see it in welfare policies. I think you see it in our housing policies, which is designed to make us buy more of the existing inadequate number of houses. We see it in the ultra-low interest rates, which Yellen and others have imposed. We see it in insolvency rules. We see it in regulation. Because the vast bulk, and we can perhaps discuss that or can question it, the vast bulk of all these today increasingly leans to supporting incumbent existing businesses. They discourage the way they act, they discourage new companies which could cause disruption and which could cause change in a positive sense, and they generally try to sustain things pretty much as they are, as if the present malaise which we are in is worth preserving. Now, this goal of stability, sometimes seems attractive in our personal lives. It sometimes seems a good, seen as a good thing, have a bit more stability. No one's going to complain about that. But for the economy, stability is a very precarious goal, because a modern economy is like that proverbial great white shark. That if it's not moving forward, it tends to be a dying. Because economic stability and having that as the goal of policy means a policy objective of stability. It means that stability really means stasis. It means no change. Same word. That turns into stagnation, which in time turns into atrophy, wasting away, which I think we can see in a number of areas. Now, I'd stress that this is not anybody's, no politician's, not Philip Hammond's intention. No politician is intending to inculcate stagnation and atrophy. Nobody wants that. But it's the result of all those pro-stability status quo policies. That's the end result, is that economic sclerosis, which we can see in productivity, incomes, and job creation, and so on. The political rhetoric is still often, in fact, more so than ever, everyone will talk about buzzwords of innovation and disruption, and we've never had more disruption than ever in the world, and we really need to innovate and all that. It's there in all the documents. But the practice, despite all that rhetoric, the actual policies pursued, I argue, are holding innovation back. And that's different to the way business cycles worked previously. Because in the past, going back beyond, prior to 30 years ago, recessions used to play a sort of cleansing role, clearing away a lot of the old capital assets, the old capital values, in order to reset relations for another bout of growth. But instead, recently, my argument is that government policies have one-sidedly been acting to preserve the old, acting to maintain the more technologically backward capital. And that's a very fundamental barrier we have today. In particular, those status quo policies have been sustaining what I call, and others call, zombie companies. Businesses that survive, but are going nowhere. They can't invest, they don't have the funds to invest, they don't have the incentive to invest, but they act to clog up the economy for everybody else and discourage even stronger firms who've got better cash flows from investing. It's not a good environment in which to invest. Because most businesses are, to use one of Theresa May's mantras in a different context, most businesses are just about managing. That's what they are. They're not thriving. They're not expanding. They're just about managing. In Britain, about a third of businesses, one estimate I saw, are loss-making. That's a big, big number of businesses not going anywhere. Another study from the Enterprise Research Council discovered that productivity, we've talked about the productivity shortage, productivity trap, productivity at a business level has been falling over the past 15 years, for over half of British businesses. Yeah? half, you know, we're talking about, you know, 5 million, something like that, businesses. Over half of British businesses in the last 15 years have seen their productivity not even stagnate, but have been falling. And the percentage, the share of businesses which have been declining, has in fact gone up in the a bit over the last 15 years from about half to about 55%. So that's, you know, a static, decaying, atrophying economy. And I think that this congested, this dull, this going nowhere, hidebound capitalism, I think accounts for all the main troubling features of economic life today, including solving what everyone perennially talks about in the economic world, the productivity puzzle. There is no puzzle about productivity. Productivity is flat because businesses aren't investing. They're not investing enough in the new technologies and in the which exist as inventions, but they're investing in innovation. That's why it's not happening. And it's this zombie economy which explains that lack of investment. Firstly, governments and central policy banks, sorry, central bank policies have been keeping those zombie, those low falling productivity firms alive who are not doing any investment themselves or just sort of ticking over investment. Secondly, this congested zombie economy is curbing the startup or expansion investment in innovation needed to create the new higher productivity jobs. So it discourages those companies from investing. And third, the expansion that has taken place, the reason why we have record employment at the moment, has been in very low investment, relatively labour-intensive and low productivity sectors that I mentioned earlier. So hence, we call the batting average effect on productivity of this triple whammy. The top performers, the strongest companies, are doing less well on average because they're investing less. The zombie economy is not a thriving economy to invest into or expand into. And then you've got the bigger tail, secondly and thirdly, of the poor performers, both the old zombie firms that are just hanging on, paying zero interest rates, and the even newer ones, like the, you know, proverbial self-employed Uber driver. That's part of the great expansion in employment, but very low productivity. So this brings me to my third point on what we can do to reboot the British economy. And that applies to other Western economies too, different degrees. In short, I think we need to clear out, the controversial point, we need to clear out a lot of those low productivity zombie businesses, which means putting a stop to those status quo policies. So there's a way of doing it. There's a leverage that we've got to do something about. Stopping all those status quo policies that are reinforcing the market paralysis and impeding the process of creative destruction. Because it's that sort of process, destroying in order to create, that sees the older, historically was the case, older, less productive businesses closed down so that they can be replaced by newer or expanding more productive ones. That's the process by which change happens, by which an economy can progress. Through that turnover of business is the way new products, new processes, new sectors are created. It doesn't generally come from within a static, hidebound structure. And the important point about creative destruction is not how it works. Perhaps people might want to discuss that or explain that. It's not how it works, but that it is no longer regarded creative destruction as being an essential feature of progress. And that's a huge shift in perspective over the course of the last 30 years. You know, for something like, you know, 200 years, really, it has been uncontentious that something like creative destruction is intrinsic to economic life. You know, go back to, you know, the classic Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, His Invisible Hand, late 18th century, that was implicit in there, that process of change. Go to, obviously, Karl Marx, middle of the 19th century, discussing the need for violent phases of destruction of capital values, he described, through to the 20th century, Joseph Schumpeter, who coined the term, actually, who in the middle of the 20th century wrote about, quote, the perennial gale of creative destruction. So for most of the history of industrial capitalism, it's just been seen as part of the way capitalism works and that progress takes place. That progress requires us to make change to the economy, either by business or by the state or by some combination of the two. But that's changed now, that's my point. But now, as far as economists and politicians are concerned, the whole notion of creative destruction is something we should be wary of and try to minimise because it goes against all the current fashionable watchwords of stability, of predictability, of certainty. That's what they're all trying to hold on to. So in conclusion, I think the biggest barrier to economic progress today, the way to bring about this start of a renaissance, is not anything structurally imposed upon us, but is this intellectual and, very importantly, this policy-backed cultural resistance to change, with the consequence that economic sclerosis becomes self-fulfilling. I think all our economic symptoms of decay are not determined for us. They are not happening to us. They flow from the reluctance to make change, and in particular from all those multiple policies that institutionalize the impulse to preserve things as they are. So the precondition for any economic renaissance, very simple to start with, you know, what should my industrial policy be? No doubt a question may arise, is to reverse the impact of all those policies which are propping up this thing which isn't working. Let me just end with an illustration. What does that mean in practice? I mean, I think, give an example from regulation. We had a session earlier about regulation. There was a general, I think, consensus that Britain is a pretty over-regulated place. Some people saw that was good, some saw that was bad. Discussion about regulation as a sort of a barrier to business investing. A point was made towards the end of the discussion, which is the one I would stress, was that regulation enforces or reinforces the way things are today, because regulation generally is from the standpoint of the existing business. So even though a lot of business say, oh, I don't like regulation, once it's established, the existing business is the one that benefits from it, because it's the upstarts, it's the startups, it's the new challengers who are the ones who are really crippled by having to accede to all these regulations. So it's one of those forces which I would argue is deadening and ossifying the zombie economy. So what can we do to that? Well, I'd say here are three things, you know, just three policy changes we could make about regulation. We could impose a bureaucracy break, which is what some countries are experimenting with, which is basically a rule, another rule to stop rules. Say, for every rule you want to have, three have to go. Very simple. You know, if you want something, you think something's so important in the economy to manage, then find three which are now redundant, right? So instead of this escalating thing, you begin to turn the tide. Second, initiate an audit of all existing regulations. And there's no question, there's plenty of auditors out there, there's plenty of regulators who've got, you know, things to do. Focus them on saying, audit everything which exists at the moment with this very simple view: to eliminate or amend every regulation from the perspective of, does it foster innovation or does it help the existing incumbent business? And if it's helping the incumbent business, get rid of it, turn it into something which is fostering innovation. And thirdly, on regulation, we could say offer an exemption from all existing regulations to new firms. Because that's the real problem. New businesses are not being established at the moment. Just say, we will have an embargo. No regulations at all on all new firms, say up to 5 years old, with the only exceptions being a very select list of laws. Laws which are to do with employee safety, consumer safety, and the companies paying their taxes. Everything else, say, have a holiday. Actually get on and do what you want to do with your business, and you can prepare. If you think you're going to succeed, well, you'll be ready in 6 years' time. You're going to do all the other things that people are doing, but you can actually get on and create your business rather than be put off by it. Now, these types of policy changes, others in the room may have different takes on that or even better ideas on it, but those types of policy changes are very easy to state, but they would represent a complete revolution in mindset. And that's, you know, what we need, really. We need a revolution in thinking. That's why I started with the intellectual problem which we have. We need that different way of thinking about things. Now, during the course of the last couple of days, I know everybody, and I'm sure everybody in this room agrees, that the old political divide between left and right is redundant, and we've been discussing in some other sessions about what the new divisions should be, what the new divides in society. And, you know, one that's been argued a lot is about divide between these are pro-democracy and those who are trying to sabotage democracy. And I think that's a good way of look, you know, a good approach to begin to think about new political divisions. But specifically with the economy, I would say as part of that creating new divides in society, we should make a political dividing line on the economy between those who think that it simply needs, the economy, a bit more status quo tinkering against those who feel that change can be an inspiring thing and necessary for economic renewal. So I leave you with that thought in terms of a new political dividing line between making change and sustaining the status quo, and that's, I think, something to take sides on.
Thanks, Phil. That's great. In a couple of questions I wanted to sort of chat through with you before we open it up. One of the things that's interesting about the book and the lecture you've just given, I think, is that it does cut across quite a lot of the contemporary imagination. So in a lot of discussion around these issues, people sort of take almost diametrically oppositional view. So people who are consider themselves anti-capitalist, but also I think it's quite a mainstream opinion, is that there's rather too much capitalism going on, too much change and disruption, rather than your position that there's not enough of it. So, you know, the impulse is to restrain and to regulate something that's seen as dangerously out of control. So, you know, it's too neoliberalist, the market's got too much power. What are all these disruptive technology startups doing to our data? They're huge. And that in itself seems to go against the grain of some of your argument, is that have you taken Amazon or Google, haven't they massively disrupted the traditional bricks and mortar industry, creating zombies which will die? They are they not themselves in the business of maybe doing what you want, creating an economic renaissance? But people are worried about it. They want to slow down and restrain it. So why is it, I suppose, just to start, why you've got such a different perception? I suppose the other example to throw in, because it will come up, is the fear of AI and robots. So people have this perception, there's a big debate going on about this, is that there's way too much of this new technology being brought into our lives, where you just explained at length in the book that there's just not enough of it.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very pertinent question. I saw a survey a couple of weeks ago in America. Americans fear, there's one thing that Americans fear more than death, which is robots, apparently. So, you're right, there is a big mismatch between the zombie economy I've been describing and the appearance that we're in a world of accelerating change. Now, I can quote the figures, and it's not just my figures, you know, a lot of more critical people have looked at these things. And the reality is, there isn't this huge destruction of jobs going on at the moment. I mean, in general, in the last 30 years ago, take the American economy, which is, you know, the Microsoft economy, the Silicon Valley economy, something like one in six jobs was destroyed every year in the 1980s. That's on average. One in six jobs was destroyed. It's now about one in 10. So it's like about a 40% decline in the number of jobs which are destroyed. And that is paralleled by looking at things like the turnover in businesses, the idea that there are all these businesses growing up, all these startups which are growing up, and as a result, others are going under. That churn is not happening at the moment. It's not happening. The percentage of startups is in fact halved in Britain and in America in the last 20 years. You know, the number of young companies of the whole has declined. It isn't happening. I mean, we think we're living a very entrepreneurial startup economy, Britain, and we'll be told, you know, 2 million more businesses, which on the books there are 2 million more businesses compared to the early part of the decade, and that's, yeah, it's a big number. I think it's gone up from about 3 to about 5 million. God, it's huge. Entrepreneurial, it's great. Actually, if you look at it, most of those new businesses employ zilch. They don't employ two people or four people. Not small businesses they are zilch employees, because they're people setting up companies because they've gone self-employed or whatever. They employ zero people apart from themselves as founders. And that's 90% of these new businesses in the last 15 years have been, which we're told is indicative of startup. So obviously there are things happening, and I think the interesting question, which I'll come back on later perhaps, but the interesting question is this paradox as to, you can look at the data and say, actually, there isn't this destruction going on, and there's not the creation going on. There's not that turnover going on in jobs. There's not that turnover going on in businesses. There's not the innovation happening. And yet, we all think it is. You know, we all think we're in this world of dazzling change. So how do you explain that paradox? I've got my ideas on that. Perhaps other people want to throw in a few things just to give...
How does it relate to the desire for stability? Because it might be you might be asking you know, world central bankers to abandon policies of, you know, stability and containment. That's sort of their day job, isn't it? I mean, do you want them to put policies in place just to make it black and white that are going to increase instability? Who wants that?
Well, you see, it's not right, Angus. It's not as if they should give up their day job. Their day job has changed. If you take a central bank, central bank was set up to monitor and oversee and regulate the financial system and to set interest rates. Its job was primarily, or it has been for a long time, was about price stability. And then they throw in, somebody has to regulate all the banks, so financial stability as well. So that's been the way that that job has emerged. I mean, central banks, not in Britain, which goes back, as people know, you know, till since fighting wars in the late 17th century or whatever, but the American central bank, the Federal Reserve that I was talking about from Janet Yellen's, was after financial crisis, so they set up a central bank, created one to try and stabilize the financial system. Mm. And what's happened is that the central bank has become not a financial stabilizer, it's become the economic stabilizer. It's adopted a role of keeping the economy as it is. And that's very different. You know, in the past, we had this this phrase which was said, you know, that the role of the central banker is to take away the punch bowl before the party gets started. That's what they were doing. Instead of assets shooting up and inflation and so on, they were to stabilize the financial system. But that's transformed itself into stabilizing economic affairs. And that's become accepted. I mean, Martin Wolf this week, I think it was this week in the Financial Times, the senior columnist from the Financial Times, said it would be a disaster if we sacrificed the role of the central bank maintaining economic stability at the expense of a bit of financial instability. You know, so he's actually turned things around. So he's saying, don't worry about the asset prices are at ridiculous rates. Everyone knows that shares and houses and stuff are at inflated rates, never mind, you know, Bitcoin and stuff. You know, there's all this money pumping in, all these assets going in. He says, we shouldn't be worried about the financial instability because that would sacrifice the goal of economic stability. The problem is, they can't achieve economic stability either. But putting it number one...
Well, there's another paradox there, is that most people looking at bankers think that they're responsible for a lot of the economic instability we've had over since the last 10 years.
Yeah.
Rather than being the guardians of security. The other thing I wonder about, and we were discussing this earlier, is why don't people just get on with it? Because we've got lots of cheap money available. A long period of historically low or even negative interest rates, so you can get the money easily. What's holding people back from investing in new technology? Because it does seem really slow. I think I agree with you. It is slow. But only just now, I think, I've been reading the last couple of months, they've got some fully one automated field in British agriculture.
Agriculture, yeah.
And that's taken a long time to come. And I'm not an expert in farming, but it doesn't seem that complicated to me to have a machine to go along. It's taken a long time, but, you know, why is it being so slow? Because you can get the money, you can just go out and do it. Surely there's some money to be made. Why are people not investing?
It's in the nature of the market economy, or the capitalist system, let's call it, which explains that it needs a perennial process of purging itself. And that's been this is what the business cycle has historically been. The business cycle has been a way of destroying capital values, which are able to still produce, but aren't able to produce enough to be able to invest in the next round of toilet. It's what we call a profitability problem. And if we look at why things slowed down between the post-war boom years of the 50s and 60s and the 70s, it was that problem of a profitability mismatch. People were making money, but they weren't making enough to invest in the next round. But that's become a self-fulfilling sort of process once you get into a depression. Because if you don't have clear rights every so often, and obviously we had clear rights in Britain and other countries, the mid-70s, for those who remember, was a bit of a clear right. The early 80s was a bigger clear right. A lot of heavy industry went under that stage. So you have had clear rights, but instead of there being a new dynamic created of new sectors being set up, instead of that, policy shifted to just try to maintain things as they were. And that creates a stultified economy. I mean, not overnight, it's been a process building up, which disincentivizes even though that do have cash to invest. So what are these companies? You talk about Microsoft, you can talk about Apple. I mean, look at Apple, you know, number one profitable company in the world. It's got zillions of cash all around the world, hundreds of billions. What's it investing in? Okay, we hope it's investing in, you know, driverless cars, you know, it's a big secret project or whatever. Or, you know, maybe it's going to do something to revolutionize television or whatever. I mean, in terms of our, you know, phones, that was great. 10 years ago, 2007 was the iPhone. That was revolutionary. But since then we've had, you know, iPhone 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever. You know, you've had incremental change, not revolutionary change. So you can't, they've got loads of cash to do it, but they don't, because the overall economy, I think, is just not creating the environment for companies with cash to invest. So you've got to clear out and create an openness for moving on to new things. Now, maybe, you know, Apple, as an example, will do the driverless car before anywhere else. Maybe that's happening, which would be great, and that would be fantastic. But the point is that the levels of innovation that we've seen are very, very narrow, is what I would argue. In previous periods, innovation has been across the board. It's been energy. It's been transport. I mean, think of all the industrial revolutions we've had. You know, it's usually been a revolutionary form of power, a revolutionary form of transport, a revolutionary form of communications. You know, across the board, there's been change in the way we've run our lives. Yet for the last 40 years, it's been just communications and information technology, really. It's been the smartphone. You know, it's been the internet. I mean, I worked in the internet industry, so did you. You know, it was, you know, that's great. You know, other people here work in this industry. That is great, but that's 1/20th of the economy, and it's not spread to changing the way we fly, really, so far. You know, we're still, you know, it's striking. I'll finish on this, but the planes we still fly are pretty much the same planes that we flew in the 1960s, you know, before most of you were born, right? The Boeing 747 was first flew in 1969, yeah? And they're still producing it. You know, going around, you know, transport, trains, right? I'm not talking about the super trains in China, but the train system hasn't really changed. You know, we're still talking about electrifying a few lines, for Christ's sake. You know, so outside that narrow area of information communication technologies, and very importantly, personal gadgets, which is why we're all dazzled by it, or one of the reasons we're all dazzled by it, because we can do these things. This morning, we had a session, don't know if Hillary's here, we were discussing the Weatherspoon app, which people were raving about. I don't know how many people go, but the Weatherspoon app means that you don't have to queue up at the bar, the Weatherspoon pubs, to get your drinks and to get your food. Now, that's great. Great convenience. I agree. But that is it. You know, we've got all these apps to do things. It doesn't change productivity one iota, right? You've still got the same number of staff there. All it means is that you don't have to queue at the bar. Great. I like it. You know, it changes our personal lives. But that's why it can coexist with flat productivity. Because a lot of these changes, 95% of these things in information technology, which we all get excited about, don't feed through into the way we produce things, into productivity. Okay. They just make our lives different.
All right, I can see some hands. Should we start at the front here? A couple of hands there, and then we'll sort of move over that way.
So I'm going to return to the familiar sort of prism of looking at this through Brexit.
Okay.
It seems to me that Brexit is a necessary but not sufficient condition for your sort of policy prescriptions. I think my concern is that, as you alluded to, there is a great fear of seizing some of those opportunities, and everything seems to be about containment and managing the process as tightly as possible. And, you know, if anyone talks about things like tariff reductions to improve competitiveness and consumer welfare, it's just this like, oh, you must hate the farmers and you want the end of manufacturing. Or if you talk about improving our regulatory environment, it's, oh, you want to roll back employment protection and you don't want to protect the environment. And I'm just wondering if you see a way of making those arguments and getting through that sort of status quo sort of defensiveness that we have, and if you can hear any voices on the political scene at the moment that we could look to make that case.
Is there anybody in the political class at the moment arguing that?
Is there any hope for us?
Yeah. Are any of them any good? If you pass it to the lady behind you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to know what you think about James Dyson, because he seems somebody who's very innovative, and he's going to invest in engineers. Yep. And I wondered if you could name any companies who you think are actually living in the solution rather than the problem, according to you.
Okay. If you pass it up on the end. Okay.
Well, I've read your book, and the one question I have is really the kind of economy you think is going to have to emerge. I mean, that part of your book seemed to me a little bit short. Maybe you can say a little bit more about that. Because, like, if you just mention, let's say, different sectors like computing or God knows what, it just seems a little bit abstract. Perhaps you could sort of develop that argument.
So what a future economy of the type, what the my fourth industrial revolution.
Yeah, yeah. I think she's looking for investment advice.
And, all right, okay.
So if you give it to the gentleman there and then over there on the right.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay. Yeah, the first question was about your sort of use of creative destruction. I think this is a causality thing here. You seem to argue is that everyone's got to throw away their phones away and then we'll invent a better phone. So it's you get the destruction first and then the creation. But what you tend to see is you get the creation first and then that leads to the zombie companies going out of business because they can't compete anymore. So I'd like to throw out another explanation that's going on.
Do you want to illustrate that? Give some examples of where the creation comes first.
I'm asking you to elaborate on destruction mechanism, yes.
Okay. Yeah,
so and what I would say is what's actually going on is the fact that labour or wages have been kept very low. Because what we saw is why the UK, if you like, was the focus of the Industrial Revolution was because we saw wages were very high in the UK. And therefore, there was a need to innovate. Yes, because wages. If wages are kept low because of an increase in the supply of labour, then the need, if you like, or the incentives to innovate are very low. And maybe that's explaining what's going on, not a lack of destruction.
Yep.
Okay, so the gentleman there on the right. Stand up.
Concerned with how your proposals will work or if they would work in relation to getting the auditors in to sort out the regulatory problem or to impose the rule about the kind of regulatory holiday, whether this kind of bypasses the other question that you raised of democracy. Because, you know, clearly if you give a company a holiday from the regulations and then they start to bring in foreign workers or they have genetically modified organisms or, they start using people's data. I mean, of course, you say, well, there's exceptions for consumer safety. There will be big rows over these things. If you try to build a new jet airliner, you can go and talk to the engineers who want to build those engines and they say, well, we'd really love to do it. The lawyers won't let us throw away the old designs and start again. Is that, you put in the exception for consumer safety. Really, these are political problems, and we need to kind of win a political argument about growth and dynamism, which it's maybe more an emphasis on the presentation, or I'm not sure, maybe not, but to present it and say, well, we can just introduce these rules about regulations, get in the auditors to survey the whole thing, doesn't seem to me like this is quite what's needed.
Phil... Very brief responses, no more than 2 minutes.
Well, no, just on that. I mean, Fair enough. I mean, I was trying to give an illustration, not that that is a panacea to solve things, but I think, Joe, your emphasis on the democracy side is very important to the whole theme, which answers the point, unfortunately, the first question is, no, I don't think anything good's going to come out of the existing political class, not because the individuals are badly intentioned or they are particularly unimaginative, but I think the political class has got a certain internal dynamic to it, and whatever political complexion, it has bought into and been brought up within this status quo mentality, and I can't see that changing from within itself. So I'm not putting forward a technocratic solution as to how you deal with regulation. I'm just saying there are very simple, I mean, I'm making the point, there's very simple policies, very easy to list things, but it's a huge, as I say, intellectual revolution, which is also a democratic revolution, because you're going to have to get rid of the people who are keeping everything down at the moment. There is only a democratic solution to it. I mean, when I was writing these books, as people in the audience know, take quite a long time to write, and while I was writing it, you know, there was nothing I could see in 2015, 2000, and yeah, that period. You know, how can I, can I make this meaningful? And then, lo and behold, we have Brexit vote, which I wasn't expecting. You know, I'm not going to say I predicted it. Very pleased about it because on the democratic grounds. But that actually showed then the democratic thing. If whatever else, you can look at it and say, well, what were people voting for? They were voting for change. Yeah. Nothing, that is what they're voting for. And that's what I'm arguing for. We need change. We need to shake things up. And this is 17.4 million, with people saying, whatever else is telling us how dangerous it is to change anything, how dangerous it is to upset the status quo on our relations to the European Union, you know, for all that was thrown at us of 500,000 unemployed and immediate recession and all the sort of social consequences and stuff, people said, no, we'll vote for change. So it's inspiring, that is, and that shows that it is possible. But it's a matter, obviously, that's not going to translate into an economic plan for Britain. But it's the raw material. So
there is a point there that people were sort of explicitly willing to undergo a period of economic hardship to get to somewhere better later on. So that's useful. Is there a microphone on the left-hand side as well, so we can sort of attack both sides at once? Okay, so there's a gentleman right at the very top in the back row. And then we'll take this young man here in the polo neck.
So I wanted to make two points. The one on cheap money and the fact that it hasn't worked very well. So why isn't this being invested? I mean, I think there's a few reasons for it. One, you could say that there's those companies have either been sort of paying down their debt, i.e. getting sort of cheaper money to replace old debt, or they've been doing things like, paying off their sort of shareholders, so there's been big dividend sort of payouts. So that's one reason. I think the other, and I work in telecommunications, so it's the industry I know best. And what most of those companies have been doing, they've been spending this cheap money on basically merger and acquisition kind of activity. Yep. You know, they've been going, so rather than going for organic growth, they're just buying competitors up, or they're buying smaller companies that are innovating, but they're not actually innovating themselves. I think you could also say the same actually in the pharmaceutical industry. People complain that there's no new drugs. Well, there's the reason. I think it's not organic growth. They're not doing R&D. They're buying up smaller competitors. The second point I wanted to make was, again, from my experience in telecommunications, I also work a lot with regulators. And I've got to sort of say, I mean, I there are a lot of very good people that work in regulation. However, they tend to be economists and lawyers. They know nothing about technology. It's not true for all countries. Actually, this country actually has quite good telecoms regulation in terms of technical know-how. They're a bit better. But for some countries, they really have no technical expertise at all. So the idea of these guys, so your prescription for the, having these commissioners, I just can't imagine that that's going to sort of work. I think we would need to sort of think of somewhere where you can get real technical expertise. And my serious point here is that a lot of the incumbent operators in the telecommunications space are actually trying to do innovative things. And it's the regulation is even stopping them. It's not just sort of stopping, you know, new companies coming in and innovating. It's stopping everyone because the technology is being stifled because people don't understand it well enough. So that would be my sort of plea, is to open it up more.
Brilliant, thank you. And can I see hands over here? So if you pass the microphone to the lady just in front, in green mic, you go.
I think I'm quite possibly in a minority in this room as a Remainer, but I thought I'd offer my kind of thoughts.
Wouldn't be sure about that.
Essentially, I agree that clearly there is an issue with stagnation in our economy, but I worry that deregulation is perhaps the wrong way of going about dealing with this. I mean, a lot of people attribute the deregulation of the banks to, of course, the 2008 financial crisis that arguably has led to a great deal of this stagnation now. But also, I would argue that the social harms caused by deregulation, for example, of startups not having to apply to any regulations the first 5 years, the environmental chaos that that might cause and the problems, you know, that would ensue from such deregulation, I would argue are far more detrimental to our society than the minor economic boost that might be gained as a result. So is there not other ways we could incentivize innovation without having to sort of abandon our laws and our principles as a nation?
I take your general point. Let's not get too bogged down on the regulation thing. It was just an example Phil was throwing out in the end just to say that, you know, we need to do something to stimulate and enable change. It's not all going to be solved by changing regulatory regimes by any means. I mean, the much bigger point here is that the one third, at least, of jobs existing in the current British economy should be destroyed. Right? That's not about regulatory change. That's about a lot of businesses going to the wall and a lot of people going onto UB40s. And Phil's arguing that's a precondition. Right, so consider that one. Where are we? Red mic, and then pass it down, and green mic, go that into the middle as well.
You've talked a lot about change in the economy. So do you believe that with the rise of automation, there's another industrial and economic revolution coming?
Brilliant. Can you pass the mic down as well? Is there another, or is automation a new industrial revolution, fourth industrial revolution?
Right.
Yeah.
I'd like to ask about what your thoughts are about the shareholder model and the market system that supports it. There's a lot of criticism about short-termism, and just unpacking that a little bit more, it seems as though up to 60% of shares are traded within 30 days, and 60% of those are done by bots, which means the majority of shareholder trading is done on a very short-term basis. And the consequence of that is that markets are now looking to CEOs to be able to deliver performance that delivers what they want to see in the next 3 months. It's become about market signals rather than shareholders having a long-term interest in what the company is doing. So the consequence of that is businesses become very nervous about delivering the numbers. So a huge amount of corporate companies now are doing more, as you would say, or Clayton Christian would say, sustaining and incremental innovation. They become very risk averse because they need to hit the numbers. So in what degree do you think the system has broken down and therefore acting to sort of manage companies to stay in this very sort of incremental innovation world rather than the disruptive innovation you're talking about?
Mm-hmm. Let me bring Phil in again. You've got the mic. You won't be taken away from me. But let me bring in Phil for a couple of responses, and then we'll carry on.
Yes, I do want to leave my example of regulation. Happy to talk about it. I think your point at the back, teleco guy, we're in the same sector, and I see the same things. And thank you for that. That sort of nuance or that sort of modification. I am talking not just about startups. In fact, you know, I think this often can be a bit of an over-eulogization of startups as being everything. It can be existing businesses doing new things, and that's what's not happening, and that's what not just regulation, but a lot of other stuff is stopping. I mean, my point on the creative destruction, just to is that ironically, I think the problem is that businesses, even though, for example, some regulation, you can say is actually inhibiting people and making life tough for startups or for existing businesses expanding. Overall, regulation and everything else I've talked about, public spending, welfare policies, you know, in-work tax credits, insolvency rules, procurement rules and taxation rules, very low interest rates. In general, the problem has been life has been too easy for business rather than too tough. Because the reason that we've had a, I would say, getting on for half a century of a depression. I'd say we moved into depression in the early 70s, so we're getting close, you know, it's over 40 years now. The reason it hasn't blown up more is that it's been possible to keep going, because there's been a lot of muddling through that has been possible. I mean, for those of a classical Marxist education, it's about counteracting tendencies. It's about ways in which the system compensates for its problems. But a lot of those are policy-led. So a lot of these things I'm describing are ways in which the system keeps itself going. So if you have regulation which stops challengers coming in, it makes life easier for the incumbents. So a business say, oh, we hate regulation, it causes all this problem. But actually, they quite like regulation once it's there, because it actually stops the challengers coming. Oh, you know, we can see the problem with very low interest rates. It's causing, you know, bubbles in housing markets and stuff. But actually, you know, businesses are, yeah, in fact, openly very, very happy about very, very low interest rates. Low wages is the example you gave. That example, I think that's a very good example of something which has changed over the last 30 years, by which the system has been able to cope. It's find life easier to cope by taking advantage of low wages. I explain in the book, you know, one of the features of the change political conditions is what happened to, as a result of the sort of the elimination or the demise of trade unionism, right? I'm not saying that's a solution, but it's a means. When you had the crushing of the unions in the 1980s, which sort of, you know, finished off something which wasn't working very well, but it has made it easier for employers to keep wages down, and that's been a survival mechanism. So these don't cause it. They're not the reason that investment stopped happening, just as today, you know, migrants coming from Romania and Bulgaria are not the reason businesses are not investing, although some people say that. Rather, they're all ways in the last 30 years that businesses have had it easier to cope, to maintain it, to keep ticking over, to muddling through. The fundamental problems of investment, of low investment, I think are prior to that. They're still there, but when you can manage to muddle through, then it gives you a reason for not investing. That's the point, because investing is a difficult thing. I mean, some of us are, you know, run businesses here. Investing is not easy. It is an uncertain thing. You know, there's no way around that. It is unpredictable, and, you know, half the time it's not going to work. Yeah. So if...
I mean,
So if you can muddle through in other ways, through low wages, through not paying much taxes, tax credits, subsidies here, there, public procurement contracts, you know, regulations which keep the competitors out, all that is, any business will take advantage of that.
Yeah, and they also start to sort of then wrap an explanation around this to say, well, we shouldn't be investing heavily anyway, because business should be sustainable, it should be caring about the environment, it should be socially responsible, it should be about almost anything you could think of apart from going out and making a profit. Red mic in the middle, and then we've got a whole row of eager hands down here. Sorry. Everybody, just take it as read. Stand up when you get a mic.
Two questions. I'm not convinced that the destruction of zombie companies is necessary for the encouraging growth companies, because I think that the... main thing that's supporting zombie companies are extremely low interest rates, and I would have thought that was also an incentive to new companies to come in and for investing in growth. And the second point I wanted to make, I think you're taking a slightly pessimistic view about these new companies that are being created that have no employees, because I work with a couple of startups, and they have effectively, they really have got employees, but they don't employ them. They're using other contractors. And this is in itself a revolution in the way that we're working, and allowing a lot more flexibility and growth. You can employ people when you want to. You can employ experts when you need them. So I don't think that's all bad news.
Right.
Okay, and pass it down. So we had, I think there's a whole little group. Yeah.
Hi.
Where's the other mic? Let's bring it down too. Okay, in there. Cool.
Feels like I'm looming over you.
I agree with what you said about we need more change, not less, and we need more technology. But I didn't get a real sense. I'm trying to figure out whether you are suggesting that this more change is to make capitalism more dynamic and more productive, or whether it's really about thinking of a new mode of production. I know it sounds really old-fashioned. I know you said that you don't believe in left and right, but I did want to press you a little bit on this. Is this about really thinking about something completely different that will come after capitalism?
Great, thank you. And give it to the gentleman there, but...
Good afternoon. So first of all, my question was, what role do you think economic monopolies have in any of this? I suppose the maintenance of them at the expense of any opportunity to change. And secondly, I'm surprised in all this talk about government policy and regulation that the biggest policy that they have that drives incentives, tax, hasn't been talked about at all. When the basic rate of tax is at 44% when you include national insurance on wages, and every single sale in this country has a 20% VAT on it.
Thank you. Good to the lady there.
I just wanted you to...
No, wait your turn.
And then on top of your 20% worth of VAT, there's also, for the next generation, there are student loans to repay, and we're all going to be enjoying 8% deducted out of the gross earnings for auto-enrolment. The marginal tax rates in our country are unbelievably high once you analyse it all in the round. And yet you say things are too easy for businesses. I must be working in the wrong sector. As a small business accountant, let me tell you, well, perhaps I've picked the wrong client. But I sort of get the feeling that your policy prescription will be all sorts of things which would be potentially quite damaging to the smaller business. I think you're implying things like higher interest rates, possibly higher inflation, possibly higher taxes to encourage people to invest and get a tax credit. We already have very generous R&D tax credits in this country. Yeah, you're certainly generous. Talking about greater churn in the employment market. That might well mean higher unemployment. And all of that, I suspect, would damage or at least make consumption unstable. And yet you want to allow fresh entrance into the market. Is there not the possibility that with damage to consumption, we won't have the market open out in the way that you're describing, because the market itself will shrink, which is, of course, what happened in the 30s?
Thank you. Where have we got to? Yes, green mic, and then...
Thank you, Phil. That was a really, really useful lecture. I just wanted to ask you to expand a bit on something I heard you say a couple of months ago about agriculture, because you said then that the EU acts as a disincentive on investment in Britain because it creates it basically gives businesses a cheap pool of migrant labour. And as a result, that's why there's no incentive for technologising agriculture. And I think that raises some really interesting questions in terms of democracy, in terms of, you know, what happened, who should be coming into the country, and how we need democratic control over this. Is it possible to have democratic immigration controls? Because certainly, having the EU flooding the country with cheap migrant labour and stopping businesses having any incentive to invest doesn't sound like a good idea for anybody, businesses or workers.
Thank you. So there's a gentleman here. Okay, and then there's one up there, and then I've got a question, and we'll bring Phil in to explain everything and wrap it up.
Thank you. I have two questions. The first is about is there a problem with the kind of new industries that might emerge, in that tends to be the case that high-tech industries are very capital-intensive and not labour-intensive. So is part of the problem around reluctant government policy a fear of the unemployment and the socially destabilising effects and the burden on the welfare state and so on of that? Where do you expect growth to come from, and is it socially sustainable in that sense? And the second issue is about your emphasis on deregulation. It doesn't seem to me that the call for deregulation is a new idea. We've been living in an era of deregulation for 40 years, and it seems to me that that cycle of capital accumulation has more or less run its course and caused many of the problems that you're talking about. the idea of a bureaucracy break is being tried in the United States now under Trump, and all the evidence shows it's just caused sclerosis and stagnation in the state. And it's interesting when I hear from people in startups, what they often say is, we don't want deregulation, we want regulation. We can't move forward without rules and laws that actually mean we're going to see a return on our capital investment. So you often hear that from people in the energy sector or drones or driverless cars and so on. They're waiting for the government to actually make a positive contribution and create the economic space, because markets are political. They're not necessarily just spontaneously created by capital. So is there not a more positive role for a more interventionist industrial policy? Because often innovations such as the internet are state-led. And you mentioned high-speed rail in China, for example. This is all being led by the state at a loss. And it seems to me that we need more of a push to incentivize companies that are hoarding capital to spend that money and change the rates of return on certain forms of investment. My partner works for an industrial company. Rate of profit is about 5% per annum. And they had an opportunity to expand with a massive contract, about $2 billion. But it would have meant taking on a lot of debt. 5% return. But they have property investments in bank where they can realise a return of 13% per annum. Why bother?
Yeah.
Why bother? And that's what a lot of companies are thinking. So actually, we need to move against the interests of finance capital to deflate asset bubbles and change the rate of return. But that would involve a lot of positive state intervention rather than just deregulation, a bonfire of the regulations, I think.
Good. Well, we'll come back to that.
Yeah, I just second those points, but also I think it's potentially some right answers, but to the wrong question, because we can't keep growing as an economy forever. We're running out of, climate change, waste. The answer we should be trying to work out is, how do we continue being prosperous without focusing on this rather kind of abstract goal of growth as the main goal of our economy?
The question I've got around this as well is similar to the point from the front, is that how do we reconcile, let's put it this way, you used the Brexit example, right? We've got the entire political class sort of slowing that process down and trying to block it and turn it into something very complicated and drawn out and trying to, do what they do, sustain us in the European Union as long as possible without changing things, as you said. So given that level of dogged resistance to the popular will over Brexit, what's going to happen, if there's popular demand for a restructuring of the economy? I mean, you can imagine, and you know this, right? Because you make the point in the book explicitly that a political restructuring is a necessary precondition of any economic reconstruction, right? Which I read as getting rid of the existing political class and a lot of the state, taking back control of the state in some form. Yeah? So can you just, and does that mean introducing a planned, sort of a democratic five-year plan? Is that what we're looking at? Just wanting to provoke a thought around that. It's okay, but Phil, you've got 5 minutes to, we've only got two, but I'm going to give you five.
Okay, thank you. Your point and the point here from the middle here is a similar one. And I'm not going to, I've sent a memo to myself, don't use the example of deregulation, because people will think that I'm just a deregulator. I'm not, that's just a small part. But in terms of what would happen in the future, in terms of the blueprint politically, I don't know. What I do know is that it will not be something which the existing political class is going to be able to cope with. Right. Now, whether that then takes us into a political transformation which involves the replacement of that political class, and we still have something which somebody wants to call capitalism, maybe, I don't know. Or maybe it will actually involve something which is more at the socioeconomic level at the same time. But what I am sure is that we can't carry on the way things are. That's why, my response on this point, basically, Phil, you're arguing, a lot of disruption, a lot of small businesses going under, a lot of unemployment, impinging on consumption and so on. My argument is that the damage has already been done, yeah? And there's no easy way out of the situation that we have, both in Britain and elsewhere. Yeah, Brexit, to endorse your point, changes nothing economically. You know, all the best it could be is that it's a bit of a catalyst for looking at things a bit different. But there's nothing which will change anything unless we, you know, take hold of things ourselves in a sense and say that we want to break away from this mantra or this watchword of just of maintaining the way things are, because stability is not secure. Even that's the irony of it. You know, we are going towards, I'm not going to say whether it's next year or 2 years' time or 3 years' time, we are going towards another crash. I'm not going to say if that next crash is going to be worse than the last one. You know, maybe they'll find some way to put some sticking plaster on for another few years, but it's not going to get any better. It is going to be getting more and more unstable at times. You can't have a situation where you're not creating wealth. Never mind just creating wealth, paper wealth, and then not investing it, but you're not creating the wealth to be able to sustain society. That's what I'm saying. Things are not, you know, stability is not achievable as simply keeping our head above the water the way we are. It will tend to go backwards. I mean, there are ways in which things are going backward. That's why not everybody, but a lot of people are finding that they're worse off now than they were before, right? And as Angus alluded to, a lot of those people were the people who were happy to vote for change in the Brexit thing, not because they thought it would create some economic transformation, but because they've had enough of life in some way. Now, that's not the only reason, there are lots of other reasons. But what I'm saying is that the status quo is not something that can be guaranteed. And therefore, it's a matter of whether you let change get out of control, which it could be in the next crash or the previous crash after that or whatever, or is it something we try and take control of ourselves? And that's what I'm arguing for, is that what exists at the moment is not something which has got a long-term future. Now, I put the stress in what I'm saying on destruction, because I think that's what's needed today. I agree with you, we could have a discussion and hopefully in, you know, 5 years' time, a discussion about all the good things, all the positive things which the government should be doing. I'm not just to be clear, I'm not a free marketeer at all. I think the state has to play that role. I think the existing state's not going to do it, or rather the existing political class is not going to do it. But that when we get to a different stage, when things have been cleared up a bit, not just the technical things of getting rid of the zombie businesses, although you're right, I mean, that's a practical form that it takes, but when you've changed that thinking, that imagination, that outlook, that mindset, to say, well, actually, change is what we need, not more of the same. That's all I'm asking for. It's not a very big thing. That's more all I'm asking for. Then once you've created that, then you can give a list, the shopping list or the wish list of what government should be doing. A lot more research funding, a lot more basic research, creating the next technologies, a lot of help in terms of you know, tax credits and stuff. You say they're there at the moment. Problem at the moment is a lot of these R&D tax credits, for example, or the investment tax credits are not used for transformation. You know, the number of people, well, we find a way, we'll turn this into a research expenditure and we can get a bit of tax credit on that. People are using it for survival. You know, you're smiling. Not you, no. I wouldn't certainly impugn you, but a lot of people do that. They get the export subsidies, they get the tax credits, they get the investment funds for doing this. It's a way of coping, right? In the same way as a lot of individuals cope relying on the state, that's the way a lot of businesses do it. And until that's changed, then a lot of these state incentives don't actually do more than create a surface veneer that something is happening, and actually it reinforces the basic underlying problem. Once we can clear that away, not just technically say sorry, clear away in terms of a political perspective, then that will be the time that we can actually put forward a much more positive view. All right, but I'll finish on that positive view because Sabina asked. And you know, maybe I'll have the same problem putting this forward as I did with trying to give a little example of deregulation. But I do think there does have to be at some stage a vision. But the stress at the moment, I think, is we've got to just get people to see that change is necessary and important and something we've got to fight for. And in that, yes, having a vision as to what the future would look like, the fourth industrial revolution, I wish there was more of it, is my basic point. Some of us will go to an automation session now and we can discuss that more. There's not enough automation, not enough revolution going on at the moment. What could that future look like? I mean, the way I've pulled together a vision of, say, Britain 2030, and rather than focus on computers or biotech or nanotechnology or all those other good things which are waiting there to be exploited, you know, the inventions have been made, the science is still pretty good, But there's not the investment turning that science, turning that technology into innovation, which actually increases the productivity, which to me is the proof that we got problems. If productivity is not moving, that's proof that we have the problems, that the investments are not happening. We can tick over, but we're not progressing. So five things for this, my Britain 2030. There are only few phrases. Have energy costs, right, number one. No matter how you go about it, you know, what technologies, nuclear fusion, whatever, battery technology, but have energy costs by 2030. Build 5 million homes in Britain. Right, use mass manufactured housing techniques you want, whatever, but build 5 million homes because we need them. Provide quality home care for all people that need it by 2030, because we know that's a big problem. We denigrate social care, it's treated as the worst possible form of employment just about, actually turn it into a role that is automated and that has some dignity. Find a cure for dementia, number four, have travel time. Whatever way, high-speed trains, planes, whatever, have the travel time. Those are, you know, a vision for how the world would be a better place. We're not prescribing which winners, we're not describing which sectors, we're just saying give ourselves a goal to actually change for the better.